two treble and a bass clef.
This must be William Morris, the morass of my life. Hello, William Morris? This is VDP. I'm fine. I'm in the arms of KCRW now. Yeah, and Bob rhymes with plaster. It's called Claster, and he's doing as clement a job as he can in this inquiry about why I exist.
This is Bob Claster, and that voice belongs to Van Dyke Parks, a talented composer whose career over the last 20 years has been incredibly varied and has resulted in some delightful music. Parks' career encompasses work with the Beach Boys, Randy Newman, Ry Cooder, Harry Nilsson, Lowell George, and Little Feat, in addition to his own critically acclaimed work. His first album, Song Cycle, released in 1967, was greeted with an unprecedented flurry of critical delight, but until the release this month of Parks' fourth album, Jump, its promise remained unfulfilled. I spent two afternoons with Parks, and for the next hour we'll be listening to highlights of his career and Van Dyke Parks' own comments. His current album, Jump, a collection of songs based on the Brer Rabbit stories by Joel Chandler Harris, was just released on Warner Brothers Records and will be performed by Parks with nine musicians at McCabe's in Santa Monica this Friday and Saturday night. Parks' professional career began at the age of nine when, as a student at a boy choir school in New Jersey, he was recruited to be in a television series with Ezio Pinza. This led to more than 100 television shows and two films. He studied clarinet and guitar as a child and majored in piano and composition at Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. In 1961, he came to California and was a staff orchestrator for the Disney Studios. He quit that to play guitar in a folk group, and we pick up his story in the mid-60s.
Well, I knew that I wanted a record contract, and I'd have to write my way through. I would have to learn how to write songs. But the very first song that I wrote was recorded. And every song that I've written, except the stuff that I just did in Boston, a production of Bertolt Brecht's Mother Courage, I've had every song that I wrote recorded, and I haven't written many. It seemed obvious to me at the time that singer-songwriters would have an increasingly emerging opportunity to record, and I thought that was wonderful. And now it's history, but at the time it seemed like a revelation, and so that's what I started to do.
What was the first song you had recorded?
The first song was called High Coin.
And was recorded by Harper's Bazaar?
Yeah. And Jackie DeShannon. And also Tammy Grimes. And she said, "What is this about high?" I said, "Oh, I don't know, ma'am." But I remember we didn't get it on tape.
We're in the heart.
signed a contract with MGM Records, and that went nowhere. I think it was two songs. Very little to go on, but just a new, an interest in writing songs. I thought it would be a better course for me to try to be a songwriter.
Had Come to the Sunshine already been recorded by Harper's Bazaar when you got the contract with MGM?
No, I just did the contract. I did that, I got $350 from MGM and did a date. And whatever was eked out of that date is on one or two records, plus this album of collected MGM artists at the time.
Well, although number nine is probably embarrassing for you to hear.
Don't want it. Yeah, don't like it.
Come to the Sunshine still holds up. There are a lot of hints of what you were to do later within that one track, within Come to the Sunshine.
To the sunshine, to the sunshine. You know that I love you. Weather here could not be finer. It suits to sail off to Carolina's shore. I'll tell you more and more over cotton threads. Keep me cool in the sun-swept afterglow. I know I'm a fool, but I'm hoping that you'll be mine in time. Sail, goat, sail to right. I think a lot of you. I really doubt you think about me like I do. Soon down it comes to the sunshine, to the sunshine. You know that I love you. While they play the white swan serenade, cornered strut, I watch them promenade. Comforted, God is made over, done in brass. Vanity Fair, who wears what, how much, and who's been where. But I really don't care unless we share. I had missed it since we went down to Port of Prince. Wicked way you rub the tinsel off my Independence Day.
You know, I love the tales that my father told about having a dance band in the Depression to support his four children and his medical schooling. And I tried to write this song in honor of my father and what he was doing at that time, and I thought that he would think it was very wonderful. And I don't think he thought it was very wonderful. But it was an effort.
Oh, absolutely. But, it was something that wasn't being done at the time. The wordplay that's involved in the lyrics...
I had taken too many drugs to make a really objective evaluation of what lyric writing must be. But at the time, I thought that lyrics could be applied to a song without respect to transitive thought, that if you would put a word that sounded good on a note, that would be enough. Well, how wrong I was. But at the time, I thought it was the thing to do. Now they talk about it, word play. Well, the reason it's word play is because it's constant... My at the time, I had a habit of writing words in sentences which were either intransitive, or for one reason or another, it just didn't follow. And so I got in a lot of trouble for what is word play. But I think it was more like to trick the ear. I wanted to trick the ear. Well, I didn't think that lyrics were very important. I didn't think anybody listened to lyrics. How wrong I was.
Well, you may be selling yourself short in a way.
I'm not selling myself short. I just think I made the wrong decision. I think that I didn't make it easy to graduate as a credible factor in songwriting, and it's too damn bad, you know, and everyone thought it was, and I knew nothing about James Joyce. I'd never read any James Joyce, didn't have any time for anything that was 20th century.
And Stephen Sondheim hadn't come around yet.
No, I didn't know anything about it. I just wanted to feed myself. I was vaulting pay toilets and gas stations because I had no money.
Well, no, I think if you wanted to feed yourself, you would have written commercial crap.
I had no idea what commercial crap was all about. But so anyway, the point is, I wanted to do something not innovative, but individual, with lyrics, and I tried. And I think that I got into hazardous territory, but I think what I'm doing now is probably because it's non-narcotic. I don't take any drugs. I do enjoy the aroma of marijuana. I really do. Other than that, I don't take any drugs, and so I think my lyrics are more accessible than they used to be in those days. The next event from MGM was that I was able to meet Brian Wilson through an introduction from Terry Melcher, who was a producer of such groups as Paul Revere and the Raiders. Mm-hmm. Brian liked me, and I liked Brian. And he was completing Pet Sounds and doing it with the lyricist by the name of Tony Asher. And he was looking for a lyricist to do some more work. So I went ahead and worked with him. And this is 20 years ago. And there's not very much I remember about it, except I needed a job, I needed money, and Brian saw to both of those things. And also, I thought he was a magnificent talent in the studio, and still do. I think he's about the best in the role of producer, artist producer, or producer arranger that I've ever met. Brian treated me very decently, and because he treated me decently, I think, I gave him all of my best effort, and I worked very hard.
Well, what survives from that is certainly lovely.
I think that
Heroes and Villains might actually be the best single track they ever did.
I think the things that they didn't do were good. Now, Heroes and Villains is a case to me, a case in point, of a very successful song collaboration, and I've always worked well in collaboration. It's never failed to amaze and amuse me. For example, Brian brought me this song, played for me the melody to Heroes and Villains, and I put a word on every syllable, or put a syllable on every musical note on the melody, and he was happy that I didn't change any of them. And then as we got to the first sentence is, I've been in this town so long, the back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Then it dawned on me that what we had here was something reminiscent of Marty Robbins, like an epic.
El Paso.
A story. There's a storyline, I thought, and quasi-cowboy type of a thing. I thought it'd be a real slice of Americana to pursue that, and that's why I called it Heroes and Villains, and I thought we should go ahead with that. And I think that it was a wonderfully successful effort, although it wasn't so big as Good Vibrations. I thought it had all the stuff of a decent, a good, well-crafted tune. Mm-hmm.
I've been in this town so long and back in the city I've been taken for lost and gone and unknown for a long, long time. Fell in love years ago with an innocent girl from the Spanish and Indian home, home of the heroes and villains. Once at night, Cotillion Square delighted, and she was riding in the rain of the bullets that eventually brought her down. She's still dancing in the night unafraid of
leash in the valley, and it's all an affair of my life with the heroes that I've killed. Children were raised, you know, they suddenly rise. They started so long ago, head to toe, helping well the
Revelations like that occur in the scope of good collaboration. Usually when two people get together, two minds in search of a single thought, and it's all very groveling and difficult. And then if you just have the time to work on it and the patience and the diligence to pursue it, it clarifies like butter, and that tune did. Mm-hmm. So I was real happy with that. And there were other things like that that were on their way to clarification or distillation through effort, and unfortunately it was nipped in the bud. I just walked away from the job of finishing the album because I was questioned by Mike Love about what Mike Love one day at a studio said to me, "What does this mean? Over and over the crow cries, uncover the cornfield." And I said, quite frankly, Mike, I don't know. And that's when I left. When I was called in to defend my lyrics. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what they meant and didn't know why I should have thought them. And rather than make it a contest for preeminence, I just decided to get the hell out.
I hope that I write for him again sometime, even more so that I hear more work out of Brian Wilson, not necessarily disassociated from the Beach Boys, but just I hope that I see him in as elastic posture as possible in his in musical interests, as he had in the 60s when he was top dog in American popular music. I'd like to see that again. And
any chance of you working with him again?
At present, I have been informed that after having asked if Brian would be interested in writing a piece with me for a pilot for a television series called Summer, and I was informed that Mike Love is Brian Wilson's exclusive collaborator. And I think that should put all of that to rest.
That's a shame.
Yes, it is.
It was a tremendous inconvenience, the whole situation, to the Beach Boys. But as for me, I got interest from Warner Brothers, from Lenny Waronker, who had just gotten an A&R job. And I got to work with Lenny on a group called the Tikis, who became
the Mojo Men.
The Mojo Men and the other one, Harper's Bazaar.
Now, were you in the Mojo
Men? No, the Mojo Men was the Mojo Men, and the Tikis became Harper's Bazaar. I started Song Cycle, as I recall, and got the body of the work done before Sergeant Pepper reared its ugly head.
Well, how were you able to persuade Warner Brothers to bankroll that? That must have been a very expensive project.
It was $34,000, $34,500 without the art change. It wasn't that much. It was heralded as an expensive record because they didn't want any other youngsters to get the idea that we should spend time in the studio. No one was spending time in the studio.
Well, there's also more than half a dozen musicians on it.
Yes, that's true. And there were, with all of the good things that Warner Brothers was doing at the time. The Dean Martin records, the Frank Sinatra records, the Count Basie records. What I was interested in doing when I went to Warner Brothers was music that had a large instrumental ensemble. I thought it was wonderful, and I would like to do it. And I couldn't see myself posing as a provincial folky, and I didn't think that I had the magnetism that it was required to wax autobiographical, so I didn't want to do that necessarily. But I knew generally the kind of music that I wanted to do would be sentimental in a way, and I thought that using these saxes and strings and so forth would achieve
that. And balalaikas.
And balalaikas, because I appreciated, I like plectrum. I like plectrum values. It's an isolable kind of a thought, musical thought, plectrum values yeah. are, as much as tuneful percussion, and I decided to, without explanation, to put these concurrent instrumental interests of mine on a record.
How were you able to persuade them to let you do it?
I didn't persuade anybody of anything. I was the right card at the right time. No one else was asking them.
What kind of demo tape was there for Song Cycle? I'd be curious to know.
There was no demo tape. I went right ahead and did the album. And I did it because Lenny Waronker had nothing else to do, and he thought that I was a good songwriter. And he had nothing else really to do.
What are you proudest of on Song Cycle?
I like Colors the best because it's an instrumental. I think it was well designed, and it's what ignited my interest in record artistry.
That is you on piano.
That's
under
right.
Your name.
Mm-hmm.
What was the genesis of that project? Was that a 45 at some point?
It was a 45. I put it out under the name George Washington Brown. It was a 4-track recording. It was 4-4. That was before 8-track machines were in use, and it required a bunch of work, and I liked it. And yeah. it was on a jukebox in Greenwich Village and was reviewed in the New York Times. It was my first review, and the only thing that was lifted from the record.
It's nice to think that the reviewer had to go to the jukebox to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What else do you like from Song Cycle?
I like Vine Street because Randy wrote it for me. I got him to write something that was introductory, and he just offered it one day. He made it up. And I like the piece called Palm Desert because I wrote it in the desert. And I like this piece called The All Golden because it was written about Steve Young, who is the fellow who sang Blackjack Davy.
That's about Steve Young, who is famous for the work that he has done that has been recorded by Waylon Jennings. Waylon would like to be as bad as Steve. That's what I've heard. That is, as lonesome, ornery, and mean. The record was referred to by one reviewer as a Chinese box, that it was a puzzlement. Absolutely wonderful reviews. In a day that you couldn't buy reviews, that pop records were of no interest to anyone.
Absolutely.
And then I got a lot of critical acclaim for my effort and also got a lot of abuse from, I'd say, in the best intentions, my album was promoted in a sale of a 2-cent sale. You return an album, you get another one free, or some 2-for-1 or something. In other words, the music was lowballed. The whole thing turned out to be a carnival atmosphere.
I liked that promotion. I remember it. And the reason I liked it
hurt my feelings. I can't explain why, but it did. And let's remember that this is 20 years ago. I was 21.
Yeah. And 21 when that record was made?
Mm-hmm. 19. Well, no, I wasn't. I was 24.
It was 68, wasn't it?
But I was 24 when the record was made. But it's just, you know, that what you asked me what my reaction to that record release and its and the critical acclaim was. Well, generally, it was uncomfortable for me, and I didn't want to pursue that tack in my life. I didn't think that was something that I was. I didn't want to pretend to be a charismatic leader. I was more interested in working for others, with others.
Were you hailed as a charismatic
leader?
For
the common good. Well, yes, it was hailed as an article of innovation and so forth, and personality, and it was a study of personality. You see, it became a study of personality rather than just simply accepted on its merits. And if it had made if it had even a broken even at the time, which of course it has by now, that doesn't. Yeah, sure, doesn't reflect itself in the accounting, but it is true. Somewhere in the accounting, it does. In creative accounting, it could be called a loss leader, which is what it was heralded as. But I believe that I had succeeded by doing the album in exploring studio techniques which today are common understanding. This was of interest to me, and I had to discover it, and a lot of other things I had to discover, and I did it all basically with in the wake of my experience with Brian Wilson, and I found that exploration and a sense of adventure might pay off.
Well, it just shows how far we've come. It's hard now to imagine a situation where someone doing a first album for a major record company would feel free to play around like that with studio time.
I played around in real short order. I was very efficient in the studio. Honest, I was. We did this stuff in short order. We found out a great deal in short order. We did a very good job. And Lenny was supportive and attendant to all of these necessities. And there was a great sense that we had nothing to compared to what compared to nothing. We had nothing to go on. I had this nagging suspicion that what Brian Wilson had put into operational procedure was sensible, that we should be making these popular records with more studio technique, with more attention to post-production and less attention to production. And that's what I did.
How did you meet Randy Newman?
Randy was a friend of Lenny's. Randy was interesting to me because he was a veteran songwriter. I think he started when he was 14. And he and Lenny were competitive and had a kind of a sibling rivalry. And I think Lenny would have not dealt with Randy at all had it not been for my integrity at telling him that it would have been unconscionable for him not to produce a record of Randy, having done one of me and Rye.
Oh, Rye Cooter Project was before Randy.
Rye was before Randy.
Well, let's talk about that one then. How'd you come to meet Rye Cooter? Was that an assignment?
He came to the house. That I remember. And I thought a lot of Rye because I thought Rye had his nose to the grindstone and was interested in social reform. And I really did believe that he, like others that I've met along this, in this rock and roll sunset, took his vow for poverty seriously.
I love of Ry Cooder's first album. Of course, I love One Meatball because it's once again it addresses in a humorous fashion the impoverished, the have-nots, and
but the arrangement.
And the arrangement is wonderful, and I did it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
One of my prized possessions is a 45 you made, The Eagle in Me and On the Rolling Sea When Jesus Speaks to Me.
That's a real weird one.
I think it's lovely.
I like The Eagle in Me because it has all double reeds on it. They're all double reeds.
Since that day when the world was an onion, it was natural for the spirit to soar and play the way the Lord wanted it, free as the sun is free. Well, that's how it's got to be. Whatever is right for is free, but that's how
But it's the flip side that I like the best. The Joseph Spence tune.
Yeah, that was a good tune. But it didn't have any market target. And like most of the things that I've done, I didn't take time to figure out if I were addressing an audience.
Well,
unfortunately.
I don't think it's unfortunate. I mean, it's financially unfortunate.
Tremendously.
Right, but I think that perhaps a lot of the things that you've done might not be quite as lovely and might not be quite as special had you targeted them toward an audience.
I guess.
Now, at what point was that done? Was that in between Song Cycle and Discover America? Or?
I think so, yeah. But I don't remember.
So that was before...
Too much about it. I think that the reason I don't remember too much about it is that I was doing my day job at Warner Brothers, which was Director of Audiovisual Services,
right,
of all wonderful things. And I was working very hard as a minor bureaucrat at Warner Brothers Records, and I didn't pay a whole bunch of attention to my own recordings.
Of the films that you did as audiovisual director, did you do one of yourself?
No. I wanted to set up the office and make it possible for record companies to appear, to bank on television subscription systems such as we have now to promote artists who thought that the demands of the road were too rigorous. And that's when I mentioned MTV to Warner Brothers and started my work on it. I had to leave the office before, of course, the popularity was divine.
Why did you have to leave the office?
Because there wasn't any market for what I was doing.
Who were the artists involved?
Well, Ry Cooter, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Brandy, Newman, and the S.O. Trinidad Steel Band, and Joni Mitchell. People that were making records at the time who already had record contracts.
Those would be interesting to see today.
Yeah. They were good films. Good films. I mean, to me.
Well, now, you released an album which was highly acclaimed and was promising, to say the least. What enabled you and Warner Brothers to allow that talent to get stuck in a bureaucratic slot?
Well, I didn't want to tour. And that was the only way they saw.
That was the only way they'd let you do another record?
That's the only way they saw to continue an act.
How could you tour with something like Song Cycle? I mean, bring along 50 musicians?
It's impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible. So I kind of painted myself into a corner there.
Discover America was, for me, a disappointment because there was no Van Dyke Parks songwriting on it.
Well, in 1971, when I was working for Warner Brothers Records and I recorded Discover America, I was otherwise distracted. I had just been slapped with a $2,600,000 lawsuit by the alleged manager of the S.O. Trinidad Steel Band. It destroyed a marriage and a job opportunity at Warner Brothers.
What are you proudest of on that?
I like FDR and Trinidad a whole bunch.
Is that Lowell George on guitar in there?
That's Lowell George on guitar. I like it, and we did it in... I remember we mixed it for Quadrophonic for fun. Somehow or another, they got their wires crossed, and you hear the voice only on one channel. But FDR and Trinidad is a wonderful song written by a calypsonian. The song has the qualities that all of these documentary pieces do out of the Trinidadian troubadours. And the thing that I loved about the songs of that ilk is that they sang all the news that was fit to sing. And I liked the way they did it and the way they designed their lyrics, and so I'm happiest about that. Andy Wickham, who was an in-house personality at Warner Brothers, reminded me of Bleak House. And I was living in a very bleak house when that suit had been dealt. And I proceeded to, in as good faith as I could muster, fulfill the expectations that Warner Brothers had about yet another album release with Parks as artist. The record was done at a time when I didn't feel that expressing my true
attitude about life, it wouldn't have been fortunate for me to have written any songs. I didn't want to do an album of the blues, and I had the blues. I was so blue, I was black. I was so poor, our maid had to live in. I just flew in from Cincinnati, and boy, are my arms tired. So I went ahead and did the albums. Did the album called Discover America, with two buses, competing lines, Greyhound and Trailways buses on the front, so I could get the group a Trailways or Greyhound bus. Warner Brothers then offered the group, I think, about $60,000 just to leave. They didn't take it, and in all good conscience, they left without another dime spent. They went back to Trinidad, where they either perished or continued. And to this day, I have a lot of friends. A lot of hearts I have left behind are in Trinidad.
Sweet Trinidad, sweet, sweet Trinidad, darling, keep your home fires burning. Use gas, don't burn any wood.
Well, I traveled the USA from north to south. I didn't need a single girl to shout about. They worked very hard, but they paid me good. I put on a little weight eating Yankee food. From Miami to New York to Los Angeles, wherever I played, the people mighty pleased. Yankee dollar really appeals to me. Never forget sweet La Trinity.
And I remember
sweet Trinidad.
Sweet, sweet Trinidad. Darling, keep your home fires burning.
Yes, yes.
Sweet Trinidad. Sweet, sweet Trinidad. Darling, keep your home fires burning.
I went ahead and did Discover America in that year. And 5 years later, recovered to the extent that I could do yet one more album called Clang of the Yankee Reaper, now, a title that I got from a poet who was a great uncle of mine.
That's 5 long years in between.
That's 5 long years. I was dead for 5 years. I was dead. I was under prescription for a great deal of tranquilizers, and in the process had my stomach pumped out 3 times.
We don't
almost died.
We don't have to go.
I was learning how to live. I was learning how to regain an interest in living, and I am not ashamed of it. Then I went back in 1976 from North Carolina, where when I was unemployed, and I was sitting in this mountain redoubt that my parents owned, and went back to California at the behest of Andy Wickham, whom I'd seen hired at Warner Brothers, and went to California to do that record called The Clang of the Yankee Reaper. The Clang of the Yankee Reaper sank deservedly without a trace, with the bones of my best friend, whom I buried at sea. And I dedicated the album to him. I was in no shape to promote or otherwise find any interest in continuing my relationship with Warner Brothers Records. I was incapable of it. Circumstances demanded a greater convalescence. And I took my damaged psyche and retreated from further record interests, seeking the more gregarious, plain speaking of the film community, and went into what you know is a timid exploration with Jack Nicholson on Going South and Popeye as a ranger conductor.
This is, I guess,
with no greater,
term.
With less satisfaction. And a stint at NBC as a musical director.
On the Billy Crystal
show. On the Billy Crystal show. It was for 6 weeks, and it paid for my opportunity in California. When I came back on September 15th of 1981 to raise the money for this project that's now called Jump.
It was around this time that you collaborated with Lowell George on a tune called Cheek to Cheek.
Mm-hmm.
I have sat with that and tried to count out the rhythm in that.
It's easy.
But we'll do that sometime. I love Cheek to Cheek.
I do too. It's and my favorite thing on that record.
Well, then I wish you'd play it.
I will. Let's hear it now.
Rosarita, I laid on your beach, dreaming and drinking tequila. I came all the way from Marina del Rey on a plane yesterday from the gray LA air.
That was written by Lowell George and Van Dyke Parks, and Lowell George recorded on his Warner Brothers album, Thanks, I'll Eat It Here. And I loved Lowell, and I think he did a wonderful job.
How did you meet Lowell George?
Lowell had an expired record contract when he first came into my office. Little Feat had put out a record which went nowhere on Warner Brothers, and I saw to it that they were re-signed, and I was their ghost producer. I'd had no title, merits, nor honors. Now I'm interested in things like that. But I did work for Lowell very hard in his record career, and he was...
deserving of it.
Yeah, deserving of it, and unguardedly grateful.
So then you played McCabe's.
I went and played McCabe's, and Warner Brothers asked me to sign, and I did that.
How did this project begin?
The project began in 1981... I was in North Carolina, licking my wounds. My unemployment that year was 8 months without a job, without an offer substantial enough to return to California and pay first and last month on an apartment. So, the letter was from a producer of documentaries for PBS. The producer asked me if I would do a night of my music with the North Carolina Symphony.
Was this song cycle he thought it was going to be?
No, he, well, thought perhaps I would do something from my records and maybe some of the Beach Boy tunes, you know, do what I wanted.
Okay.
Well, I knew at that time that my musical outpourings were insufficient to support an evening with a symphony, a good farm team symphony like the North Carolina Symphony, and so what I did was agonize. I read 25 books on Southern folklore, beastly legends, all kinds of stuff, novels, and general drivel relating to Appalachia. And what I thought was a good literary spinal tap withdrew the fluid that we now know to be the tales of Uncle Remus. It was an inescapable article of faith which I thought would provide an excellent subscription concert
and an excellent basis for an improved subscription interest in the North Carolina Symphony concerts that would find itself into the hearts and homes of a great many Tar Heels, and I thought that it was something I should do. To exculpate, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, to exculpate.
I think the two is his as well.
and Rimsky and Korsakoff would both agree, to exculpate the living, to make faultless the living, by reintroducing these tales, which were at one time commercialized with Walt Disney's effort, Titanic animation effort, of called Song of the South.
What was the first song written for this project? Which started it?
First song was called Jump. The second one was called Opportunity for Two, and so forth. It was just chronological.
They were written in sequence?
So the sequence is chronological to their authorship.
So it started instrumentally.
That's right. I came across the country. I wrote that down on the way across. And when I got here, I wrote Opportunity for Two, a verse and a chorus, and then asked Martin Kibbe to come in and join me on the rest of them.
What were the mechanics of that collaboration? Did you start with... I am asking you, which came first,
piano,
the words of the music?
My piano, titles, melodies, and some lyrics, and Martin played foil for me. He was very, very generous of him. And so he gets half of the glory and the money.
Like honey to be, it's just you and me, in love for a day.
I find disappointing in Jump
is
I don't hear enough piano on it. When I saw you do the songs in McCabe's, I was really struck with what
they is a general enough term. They were going to tell me not to play any piano at all. And when I found out that the other pianist that would come to the studio would cost me $2,000, I told them I couldn't afford it.
Why
to use me instead?
Other than you?
Because I'm not good enough for him, perhaps. And I want to tell you something. I'm in a book written by the dean of the school, the University of Miami, on his own recognizance and an initiative, called me up and asked me three times before I told him what I had done with my short life. And I'm figured in this book as one of America's great jazz pianists. And not to be able to work on my own album was beyond the pale as a pianist.
Have you done any jazz? You mentioned that you're listed in this book.
I am one of the jazz greats of the 20th century keyboard.
You know, I always said it's Oscar Peterson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Van Dyke Parks.
Exactly, exactly. But, I mean, it's funny to me that I should end up in a book of jazz greats of the 20th century, but I did. And now I accept it because I have three children. It's easier somehow. It won't change the final judgment.
Who was in a position to say that to you?
The producer of the record.
Why were you not the producer of the record?
Because I'm known, I think, at Warner Brothers as a person who has a history of a profligate spending. And they wanted a producer to govern over my... my own whims. And so what I did was hire a producer, and I had a happy relationship with him, but for 2 points. One, that he questioned my pianistic ability. Two, that I told him to go ahead and mix the album and subject it to my approval before it was mastered, and that was not done. Had I mixed this album, you would hear the kettle drums before the montono at the end of Look Away. They can't be heard at all. And when somebody is beating his brains out on timpani, you should be able to hear it if he costs $2,000. The album was tracked in 3 nights. A lot of money was spent on 47 pieces, the instrumentalists. And they played these tunes sometimes to take three. And we got it in the can. The album was delivered on February 7th of 1983. And it sat there at Warner Brothers Records for a solid year before release.
Why did it spend so long on the shelf?
I think it spent a long time on the shelf because Warner Brothers was trying to figure out how to merchandise it and then couldn't, and released it anyway.
What will you be performing at McCabe's? The entire album?
I'll be performing most of the album and several new selections. Although I've written songs in the past year which relate to other projects, the time now is for me to promote this album, and I want to, and I think it's going to take exposure and practice. We'll almost be earning as we learn at McCabe's.
So apart from Robert Greenwich on steel drum and Buell Neidlinger on bass, who will be with you at McCabe's?
Kenny Watson on hammer dulcimer, Tommy Morgan on harmonica, Kathy Dalton singing the broads parts. Gail Levant is the best harpist in town. The orchestrator is Lenny Niehaus.
What are the expectations for this record?
The expectation is a demonstration record for a Broadway musical. And I have a small chance, very small chance, of getting this musical demo mounted on the Broadway stage.
Well, you've got a good
And I'll tell
start.
You why. Did you ever hear the story about the guy who went into the taxidermist's laboratory with two rabbits that he had shot? And the taxidermist said, "Fella, do you want these rabbits mounted?" He said, "No, thank you. Shaking hands will suffice." Well, it's a funny thing. Seriously, though, I just flew in from Cincinnati, and boy, are my arms tired.
Vroom, vroom.
Vroom. But,
Kenny Bunkport.
Seriously, though, Joseph Papp is the biggest producer on Broadway, the most venerable potential producer for this project is a musical. Called me up last week and told me he's a big fan of mine since The Mojo Man, Harper's Bazaar, and the Beach Boy lyrics, which is good. And if there is any merit in it, he'll be interested. And then we'll, in Teddy Kennedy's words, cross that bridge when we come to it.
Tonight, all in hope in the she would.
Are you still under contract to Warner Brothers Records for another record?
No, they have no further responsibilities toward me.
Nor do you have toward them?
No, not really. I don't. You know, I don't have a record contract, but if Warner Brothers does anything constructive for me, I'll stay there. Because I'm a nice guy. And I'm a nice guy because I'm scared. I don't want to do anything that will distress them.
Well, I mean...
No, I'm serious. That's the way I treat... I mean, I clean up before the maid comes. I try to be nice to people. Regardless what happens professionally, regardless what it takes in record sales to make the expenses of this album, I know I didn't make but a couple of months' rent out of this. My rent is terrible. In Hollywood. No matter what happens, I'm going to go ahead and forge some new projects in American folklore that can be treated musically. And I'm going to savage all the best of them. I'm going to do Twain, Irving, London, anything that I can get my filthy little mitts on. James Whitcomb Riley. I don't care if it's McGuffey's Reader. I'm going to take them one by one in a vertical hierarchy of importances. And of course, I have a few things in mind.
Well, if that's what it takes to inspire you to get started.
Well, it takes something to inspire me, and it's a sense of history that propels me. And I think that it's beneficial to take an item of common thought that has the benefit of popular cognition and treat it in a novel fashion. I hope that I'm successful at it because it's my last redoubt. That's all I can see that's left for me to do. And fortunately, there's always the theater.
You've been listening to A Visit with Van Dyke Parks. My name is Bob Claster, and I'd like to thank Deirdre O'Donohue for her patience and support throughout this project, not to mention her generosity in letting us use her airtime. Thanks also go to Van Dyke and Sally Parks for their gracious hospitality. Sound effects were by Richard Parks, and choreography was by Elizabeth Parks. A final reminder, Van Dyke Parks will be performing at McCabe's in Santa Monica this Friday and Saturday night, and having seen the show, I can tell you that it's a show not to miss. Thanks for listening, everybody. Back to you, Deirdre.